Hi, and welcome back to another episode of In Our Tech Society. In our last episode, we talked about what it means for workers to be constantly monitored and quantified in their work. And there are two themes that we're going to pick up from that and really run with in this episode in the context of the US. The first is how this data allows for management of workers through algorithms, algorithmic management. And the second is that this constant quantification of workers produces a huge mass of data. And while there's some awareness about the debates about protection of consumer data in terms of social media companies and cookies, etc., less discussed is the protection of workers' data. I'm really excited to get into this. Here's my brilliant guest for today. I'll let her introduce herself.
Okay, my name is Aiha Nguyen. I'm the Program Director for the Labor Futures Initiative at Data and Society Research Institute.
Fantastic. So we're going to be talking a little bit about the work that you do at the Institute. But firstly, just as a bit of framing, you wrote an article in the Washington Post a couple of months ago about how US labor law has its roots in kind of the dynamic and the rules that govern the relationship between medieval masters and servants. Could you just explain what you meant by that?
The United States, being a former colony of the British Empire at that point, adopted many of the similar norms and hierarchies that existed, and one of them was this master-servant relationship, which essentially dictated the basis for modern employment law in the U.S. Part of it was a distinction between enslaved Africans and essentially what are called free laborers. But the relationship still existed in the sense that there was a master or someone who hired a servant to work for them. And part of this also contained responsibilities for both parties, for laborers or servants to provide the service asked from the masters. And masters were also obligated to do certain things like make sure that they were paid, but also, for example, paying compensation in the event of injury. And over time, this relationship has evolved to create more formal laws. For example, injury law used to be sort of left up to the master to determine how much injury had occurred and what was compensated. And this was very individualistic, could be capricious, or people had to rely on the courts to make that determination. So U.S. injury law has sort of changed that to sort of normalize, create some norms and greater protections for workers as a result. But sort of this idea of if you're working for someone or a master, when you're within that relationship, you are beholden to what the master determines, including surveillance, use of certain technologies and tools, as long as it's pretty broad rights, but within the normal business operations that are set out there or occurring on the employer's property or office.
So the employer, the master, if you like, sets the rules of the house, and as an employee, you have to obey them. And the difference, I guess, we have in the modern era is that, in theory at least, you're free to leave if you don't like the rules and go somewhere else. But how well does that work if all comparable workplaces have similarly bad conditions, for example, or you're reliant on the wage, which you are unless you're pretty wealthy to start with?
Yeah, I think it is. It has been at least proven to be a challenge in the U.S. I think, you know, we see low-wage jobs, they're low-wage jobs, and leaving one generally, you know, there's a minimum that's set for wages. And so that's one way in which some of the conditions can be improved, including, I mean, there are other laws that exist, but it is a challenge because it is a matter of, you know, what is available out there. And I think the article in which you reference, it was the basis for it was this court decision in which a judge decided that workers at this medical healthcare facility could not actually leave their place of employment. So even this very basic idea of like, it's an at-will relationship and either party can terminate that contract at any time is being challenged. And that kind of is left in the hands of policymakers or the public to determine.
So that's the legal framework. And one thing about your work which is worth emphasizing is that you focus on algorithmic management rather than automation more generally. Why is that?
We focus on that because I think the public narrative around the future of work is that everybody is going to lose their jobs because of a giant robot takeover. But that actually isn't happening. What really is happening is increasingly work is being managed by algorithms and AI. And the consequence is not necessarily a loss of work. People still have work. It's a loss of control. And particularly in the gig economy, what you see is a shifting of risks of doing business onto employees and workers. Earlier, we talked about sort of the idea of the master-servant relationship and the responsibilities that the master employer has. But with this like use of algorithms, we're having greater shifting of those risks onto workers. And this isn't a new phenomena. We've seen this with the fissured workplace, which basically saw a lot of companies contracting out and subcontracting work. And now the gig economy is essentially built on this idea of the independent contractor who assumes all of the risk and responsibility of doing business because they're independent contractors. And the application or the app is only managing them, but they're not, in theory, controlling the conditions of work that the independent contractors are engaging in. Now, many would argue that this isn't true. And our work shows that algorithms and algorithmic management does have quite a lot of control over workers on gig platforms. And I would like also add that algorithmic management isn't just isolated to gig work. It's being used in pretty much any industry you can think of. There's some version of it.
So you talked about this idea of shifting risks to the worker, essentially. Could you just sketch out what that means kind of for workers' lives?
Yeah, a good example would be employees or workers who no longer receive benefits. They're not subject to a minimum wage. They'll have to cover their own workers' compensation, unemployment, disability. If they're a delivery worker, for example, they have to cover the cost of their vehicle and any insurance associated with that as well. So if you had been an employee, the vehicle would have been owned and maintained by the employer. Employers would have been governed by minimum wage and other public benefit requirements like workers' compensation and disability insurance.
And could you just give us an example of how it's being applied in a different non-gig-based work context?
Yeah. One example, when we think about, what is the point of algorithmic management? It's essentially, it serves many purposes, but one could be sort of the regimenting of work. And an example is cashiers in a retail location. The machines that they're using, the cash registers they're using, are often collecting a lot of data about how they're working, how fast they're scanning, how many returns they process, how much money that they're processing at a certain time. And so all of these metrics can be used to determine whether that employee is considered working efficiently or performing well or not. We don't think about it that way, but that's a form of management as well.
It's not something you really think about when you go into the supermarket every day, is it?
No. And if we think about, self-checkout, that's another way of sort of, people refer to it as automation, but it's essentially a way of like getting customers to do the work themselves.
And is there something about the technology that makes it easier for these companies to shift risks onto workers?
Part of it is a narrative. It's a narrative of, independent contractors. So it's a rhetoric about independent contractors should be assuming all the risks of business because they're independent contractors. But part of it is the technology, because there is no human manager. It gives Yara that really the control is within the individual. But algorithms can hide information. There's a huge information asymmetry, which makes it much more difficult for workers to be able to make all the decisions had they been an independent contractor.
Yeah, and I guess some people would say that there could be benefits to this kind of management in terms of potentially, I don't know, if you have a particularly horrible boss or a particularly, I don't know, racist boss that gets away with it, and you have an algorithm which isn't those things, which we know there are lots of issues with algorithms being biased, but in theory at least, that you could be able to get away from that and have maybe a more quote unquote fair boss if it was an algorithm.
Right. Yeah, that is an argument that's made, is that algorithms are not biased. But I think that in employment, it's not just bias that's the issue, with so many other factors. And in theory, an algorithm is still, what it optimizes is still up to the boss. So if the boss chooses to optimize for certain neighborhoods over another, then it could still be discriminatory. And I think when it comes down to it, managers also have a boss, so it companies can also take concrete steps to minimize bad bosses. So it's not impossible to escape a bad boss, and algorithms are the only way to do it. Yeah, but definitely, that argument of algorithms being less biased, it has, and favoritism being a challenge in some jobs, has been brought up before.
There's this concern about kind of employers holding data about employees quite a long time after they've left the company, and there's not really any justification for holding that data. What do you think the employees are worried is going to be done with that data? Or do you think it's just the principle of it?
I do think a big part of it is the principle of it. Is there a usefulness to it, and what, who does it actually belong to? So I think that that's one aspect. I think another consideration is that it's not just employers that have that data. Sometimes the technologies that are used are a third party company that may also have that information. And I think there's the concern that it could be sold to data brokers, are used in other databases and other ways that appear and affect employability in the future. That's been an issue that we've seen with retail workers. There's an existing database of retail worker theft. These are just accused, not actually founded accusations, that seem to float around and are used to determine a worker's employability in the future. So data is one of those things that can have a long-term life, and I think that that's why hoarding of data, or someone else's controlling of that data, is such a problem and a concern for workers.
That last point to me is probably the most terrifying.
I mean, we sort of already have versions of this. People don't really think about it. Maybe in the UK there isn't, but for example, like criminal background checks, right? You may have served your time, whether that be a big or small thing, but that question and that history sort of continues to travel with employees. In the US, there's also this very unclear reason for why, but credit checks sometimes are requested for people seeking employment. And your credit history is just there forever. So there are versions of this, and technology sort of creates an even a performance technology and algorithms that collect worker information create another potential source of types of data that could have a longer term life.
One piece of terminology that IHA uses in this next answer is biometric. So biometric data is unique physical or behavioral data. So that could be fingerprint, that could be face, that could be your voice pattern. So this next question is all about data privacy protections. And originally it was going to be about how consumers are quite well legally protected and workers aren't. But it turns out I was being a bit too European in my assumptions there, and that consumers aren't actually very well protected in the US either in terms of data privacy, certainly not at the federal level. There are a few states which are exceptions. So let's put this question differently. How well protected are workers in the US in terms of data privacy compared to consumers?
So in the United States, there is no federal data privacy legislation. There are currently a few efforts to introduce legislation, but a handful of states have introduced and or have passed data protection laws. California has passed one. And interestingly, a couple of states have passed very specific legislation around biometrics. But for the most part, these apply primarily to consumers and so far none cover workers. It's such an interesting concept because, one, if you have a lot of workers who are considered independent contractors, essentially they've signed a user agreement. So they are consumers of the technology, but they're being excluded and put into this category of workers. So that's certainly something that could be debated as to whether workers are covered or not. But currently there is no data privacy for workers who have an employer.
And why do you think that is?
I think a big reason why we don't have data protection for workers is that employers believe it's their prerogative to collect this information, going back to the original master-servant discussion. And algorithms are used by employers for multiple reasons. One, they use it to direct the flow of work, and so it is useful to them. And in other cases, algorithmic management can be used to protect assets or company information that they don't want to share. And so they propose multiple reasons for why they need to have this information, need to collect this information. But other times, I think the argument is that it would just be too costly and too difficult for them to, you know, be able to protect some of these, this and provide some of these protections. But again, I think that really is untested, and especially in Europe, where the general data protection regulation is in effect, we may see that it actually is possible to do this. So there are reasons that employers provide, and I think that's the main reason why there aren't strong worker privacy data privacy legislation. But other countries that are making an effort to do this show that there is a pathway to do that.
And what would you like to see in terms of legal protections of data for workers?
I think what I would like to see is currently the framework that's being considered for consumer privacy is about individual data protection. And I think in employment, this is insufficient because the data is not simply important because it's one individual. It's the aggregate data that's used. It's sort of the rate that all workers work at is what's used as the benchmark to determine productivity or performance, for example. So really, I think it has more to do, it's not just about individual data, but it's also how that data is used. So I think that's important to also consider as well. And I think an important consideration is to ask, is it necessary to collect this data? Is it really necessary, or is there an easier way to do it, or a less intrusive way of doing it? You know, for example, a lot of companies are using fingerprint scans or facial recognition. You could also use a key card. So there are less intrusive ways, but technology is sort of presented as this, it can be so much more efficient to do it this way, but what are we giving up for that efficiency and convenience? Tim Wu used the term tyranny of convenience to sort of think about when and where we should be putting limits on when and where technology is used.
I find this idea of collective data really fascinating because we tend to talk about data, as you pointed out, as something specific to an individual. And when we talk about the right to privacy, for example, we usually frame that in terms of individual data for obvious reasons. But could you just say a bit more about this idea of collective data and how it can be used?
One way in which workers have started to think about collective data is there are a handful of organizations creating data trusts and data co-ops in order to basically leverage that data for the benefit of workers. What could that data tell workers that would be useful to them? Would it be able to provide them information on how much they're collectively actually earning? So what is the average rate or minimum wage, which is not clear? It could provide transparency in terms of how algorithms work. Others are looking at collective data in order to see like patterns in driving and where might be a good place to provide sort of like a pit stop for drivers in a particular city, because drivers need to find a restroom or heat up their lunch or, you know, do something else that requires being outside of their car, but they may not be able to make it home in time.
That's really interesting. So certain types of, obviously, collective aggregate data can be used to say that you're not working hard enough or whatever, but it can also be used to argue that you're not being paid properly or that certain things can be improved for workers. I hadn't thought about that side of it as well.
Yeah, there have been a couple, I think there was one lawsuit against a bunch of gig delivery platforms for tip theft. Basically, companies were using the tips in order to meet a minimum wage that they claimed that workers were receiving. And so, you know, it was only through collectively getting information from many workers that this case was made.
It's really interesting. And then there's a further complication here with this, which is that kind of when we're talking in the context of privacy, we've got kind of workers and consumers clashing on this. Could you talk a little bit about the problem that comes there?
In this case, I think what we're referring to is tech companies really closely control the information that they have. And particularly when it comes to cities trying to understand the impact of, say, you know, ride hailing, which has completely disrupted the taxi industry and transformed travel patterns, car patterns, even train patterns. Cities want to be able to have access to that data in order to understand, for example, how travel patterns have changed. But drivers are picking up customers, so it's also customer information, for example. And I think one clear example was in Los Angeles or Southern California, where the city wanted to collect information on the location of the scooters that are all over the city in order to figure out how to regulate them. But customers were sort of objecting to this because this was it was definitely tied to consumers who were using these vehicles, because that was the audience for who was using the scooters. So it really was an interesting case of the city needing information in order to provide some regulations for a new type of technology and or not just technology or type of business, and consumers who felt like that might come at the expense of their privacy.
And is there also kind of a clash between workers and consumers in this context in terms of potentially safety or something like that?
Yeah, I think some would say that there may be a conflict between consumers who want lower prices, cheaper rides, and workers who want a decent pay. But we haven't really seen that this has been, you know, obviously part of why ride hailing has scaled so much is that it is cheaper than a taxi. But at the same time, the companies have not actually turned a profit yet. So there is a question about the long-term viability of this model. But I don't think that there's been a lot of public pushback against making sure that workers who are driving end up making a decent earning.
Yeah. I mean, because obviously if something is cheap, that presumably isn't coming out of the company's profit line. So that's coming out of the workers' paychecks mostly.
Yeah, essentially. And there's, you know, and companies sometimes can take very large cuts of the fees that are, or the charges that are being made on trips, for example.
Perfect. Yeah, thanks so much for speaking to us today, Aya. It's been really interesting talking to you.
Yeah, likewise.
Now, if you enjoyed this episode, I think you'd really like the previous episode entitled The Quantified Worker, which touches on datification of workers, what it means for their identity, and also content moderation. The other episode, which I think you'd particularly enjoy, is called Your Boss is an Algorithm, and it aims to answer the question of how to make sure that innovation is used to benefit workers and not just increase surveillance of them. Remember to share this episode with anyone you think might be interested. It would really help us out. Next time, we'll be releasing the first of 3 episodes on the future of the trade unions, which I'm really excited for. And next week's episode specifically will be all about workers' rights and trade unions in China. See you then.